Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to the Curzon Film Podcast. Today I'm joined by the lovely Ursie.
Hello.
And the lovely Jenna.
Hiya.
And I am the adequate Harry. Hello. Today we will be talking about the Dardenne brothers' new film in which Adèle Haenel, doctor turns detective, and hopefully, if we have time, in this bumper episode, we will also be looking at Spike Lee's No Bars Hold as a group of women take on the Chicago gang culture in Chirac. But first, I would like to ask both Jenna and Ursie, if you could choose a film character to solve a crime with, who would it be and why? And you're not allowed to choose a detective or any sort of police cop or anything like that.
No Poirot.
No Poirot, no Sherlock, none of that.
Okay.
So, Jenna, would you like to go first?
Okay, I'm going to go with Meryl Streep as Julia Childs in Julie and Julia. Because I don't think you get enough of Julia Childs in that film. So I think she could have her own spin-off film.
Okay.
Where there's some kind of murder in the TV studio while she's doing a cookery and she's got to solve it using various implements and like knowledge of weights and flours and things.
Like a whisk.
Yeah.
A misplaced knife.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, lovely. Lovely. And Ursie, who would you go for?
Like many other questions that I answer in my life, I'm going to have to go with the dude, Jeffrey Lebowski.
Okay, yeah.
Because he is tried and tested in the field.
Well,
he can investigate a crime. He'll always have a white Russian for you. And if anything, the company of John Goodman as well with me is just great.
Would you want that John Goodman character with you?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Because I'll have Lebowski with me.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
He's basically his deterrent. So it's fine. They're... just their dynamic duo is going to investigate. I'm just going to sit back and watch.
Nice. Nice. Any crime in particular?
Anything house invasion related,
okay,
I think,
okay.
Really.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. That makes sense. Okay, I would go for Tom Selleck's character in Three Men and a Baby. And hear me out. So we have Three Men and a Baby.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We have Three Men and a Little Lady. Mm-hmm. I would ask Tom Selleck to solve the crime of why we have still not had Three Men and a Little Bride. It's been rumoured for years, and yet it still hasn't happened.
So he's going around studios in Hollywood.
Yeah, exactly.
Who's got the rights to it that's not giving
yeah,
up?
Who's not doing it?
Mm-hmm.
Who's the issue there? Is Ted Danson the issue? Because
I was going to say, it's probably Ted Danson.
Because we need to solve this, and we need to solve it soon.
The world needs it.
Exactly, exactly. Okay, let's move on. We are going to start by talking about Unknown Girl, in which a doctor called Jenny refuses to open her surgery late in the day, and the next day a young girl is found dead. It's a very very serious film, obviously, judging by the by the plot line. What were your sort of an initial reaction to the film?
It's very understated. I think that's in their style, isn't it, the Dardenne brothers? It's all like kind of handheld. There's no music. It feels very true to life because of that. And there's such lovely shots of her face and the kind of worry and panic she always has. You're very with her and her struggle the whole way through.
Yeah, she's pretty much in every scene.
Yeah, I was trying to think that.
Yeah.
I don't think there is a scene she isn't in. Barely even a shot she's not in, really.
Yeah, like, it's definitely her film.
Yeah.
And she, and what did you think about her as a character? Do you think, was she believable, first of all?
I think so. I definitely could relate to her and her struggle to do what's good and also to try and look after herself and how she was weighing that up within the film.
Yeah.
I think that she kind of let that get too far and she put what was right and what was good ahead of her own personal needs.
Yes.
And actually, I don't think you can be very good at what's good and right if you do put your own personal needs at the back. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yes.
And so I think that was quite an interesting thought as a doctor, because you've chosen a life of helping people. Does that necessarily mean you should sacrifice yourself, and how does that work? So I was quite interested in that the whole way through.
Yeah, I very much believe that she was a doctor straight away.
Yes.
Like, she had this, she very much put a shield up, and there was a very obvious scene early on in which she sort of said you can't get over emotional and you can't get too attached. And
yeah, which
and
is funny, because that was the opposite of what she did the whole rest of the way through.
Yeah, she completely didn't go for that,
mm-hmm.
apart from in a sort of right at the beginning. So as soon as this event happened with this girl turning up and dying, she then completely flips and doesn't become the same character.
I think even though the Dardenne might not actually agree with this interpretation of the character, she almost has a saintly dimension to her lets her one sin, her one transgression, define the rest of her time in that doctor's cabinet and the rest of her life. And I think that she, in every Dardenne movie, there's always, like, morality is always a major theme in it, and the dilemma is always the engine that kind of drives the movie. And her entire kind of goal in this is to forgive herself and to actually take responsibility about this horrible thing that happened, about, you know, facilitating that girl's death, effectively.
Yeah,
or the way she says it.
That, like, you know, no, if anyone should feel guilty, it should be me, you know.
Yeah.
I killed her, even though she didn't.
Yes.
She often has that on herself.
And nobody else takes responsibility for that woman's death.
Do you think if you were in that same situation, and obviously this is an incredibly difficult question, but if you're in that same situation, do you think you would feel that much guilt about not opening a door? It's not like she killed her. It's a case of, you know, running
difficult.
Late at the surgery, not opening the door because they're running late, and then finding out this shocking news. Do you then have this burden on you? Is that fair?
I don't know. I think it's things that we do naturally, though. You know, like, sometimes you think, oh, if only I was there, then that person wouldn't have done that, and then they wouldn't have hurt themselves or anything like that. Or, like, oh, I should have offered to do that, and then they wouldn't have burnt their hand on the kettle. Or, you know, you can always blame yourself for things like that, and I think that's only natural. I think she's a little fragile with how overworked she is in that situation. Like, we see, really, that she's taking on the burden of the kind of whole lower class medical care in her kind of area. She's offered this sort of flashy job in a swanky, nice doctor's office where she'll treat people who have got money and there's a team of them, but she refuses it due to this guilt over not letting the girl come in, and is just sort of working for very little money, working all hours, sleeping in her surgery, the buzz is going at night. And so I think she's kind of broken down by her grueling work schedule and kind of how depressing what she's seeing is on top of the guilt of this crime.
What did you think of her as a... Because I do think she massively overworks herself throughout the whole film. What do you think of her and the house visits? Because I thought they were really interesting, because we, you know, if I normally go to the doctor, I'll just go to a GP surgery or go to a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Don't normally have a house visit. So what did you think about seeing the sort of house visits and how she was in people's homes? Do you think that changed the way you thought of her as a character in terms of the way she feels and the way she interacts with people?
Well, the house visits are a given in her profession anyway, especially with the man who has onset diabetes and can't walk to feed the meter will heat his house. And I think that the camera work in those during those house visits is really interesting, because we really do get close-ups of her having physical contact with her patients, treating them, and there's a sort of tenderness that goes into that.
Yeah.
There is they're slow, they're really lovely scenes, and I think we see more of Jenny there in those houses than we do in her actual doctor surgery. Mm-hmm. It's she's happy to do that. But I also think that part of it as well is, you know, her turning down her swanky job at the Kennedy Center and things like that. She is so burdened with responsibility mm-hmm. over one person's death that she will be, even in a saint way, will actually take on everybody. And will dedicate her life to them. And, you know, she's incredibly courageous to do, especially in an urban center like Liège in Belgium.
Yeah, there's one point where there's a couple that come in and she says, I can't help you. Your insurance is fake. Mm. And they go, oh, but you helped my brother. And she goes, but he was dying. And they go, well, that's not good enough. And then they try and steal a couple of things.
Yeah.
And he gets incredibly aggressive. And you could see she's shaken by it.
Uh-huh.
And that feels like that could play out almost every day in the sort of surgery
she's in.
Yeah,
there's a couple of people quite physical towards her.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
And she's quite a small lady, but she really holds her own, I think.
Yeah.
It's funny because she doesn't always come across as terribly confident.
No.
When she's dealing with people, which is kind of always the impression I've always got from any doctor, because you always want to fill in the safe pair of hands.
Yes, yeah.
But she is quietly determined, and she's very tenacious, and you can see how much she's making a difference in these people's lives. You know, like the man with diabetes, she might be the only person he sees, and things like that. And the very beginning, the boy with cancer who sings her that song to say how much he appreciates her.
Oh, yeah, that's lovely.
That's one of my favourite moments in the film, actually.
Yeah, I think that's really nice. I think all I would say is, I think in a way, the event, while obviously it does change the fact she doesn't leave, I think almost anything could have happened and she might not have left.
Yeah.
I think in a way, and it's hinted at when she speaks to a former mentor, I think, or someone that she did work for, he goes, oh, you've changed your mind, you're going to go and sell out in a way. And she sort of says, like, oh, yeah, well, I've grown up now and I'm slightly different. Mm-hmm. And then this event happens, and I think anything could have happened. I think the intern not coming back may well have been enough for her not to go. I think she is almost always looking for something to stop her from going. Because when you see her going around and someone drops, like, someone gives her a waffle or someone gives her a cake when she's doing these home visits, mm-hmm. she becomes a different person to the one she is in the surgery. Mm-hmm. She becomes someone that seems to really thrive off this work and seems to really love it. And I don't know if she could get that satisfaction by going into sort of the bigger practice.
Yeah.
With the money and the technology.
I think she's plagued by, like, white liberal guilt
quite
a lot throughout the film. And you're right, I think anything could have tipped her over the edge to stay. But I wonder if actually, although, yes, because she's got this guilt and because she does care, it does make her good for the role because, you know, people that need help need someone that cares about them. But almost, potentially, she's not strong enough and she cares too much that maybe she can't be delivering the best level of care. As someone who could put aside that, like she's kind of saying at the beginning, you can't make a good diagnosis when you're emotional about things.
Mm.
I think she does have the tendency to become too emotional about things, and maybe someone who is a bit stronger and could distance themselves more would be a better fit in that practice.
Yeah, that's
but
true.
I don't think she could pull herself away from it.
Yeah, exactly. Do you think? Do you think in terms of getting in terms of the police and her relationship with the police, do you think she goes massively too far, or can you completely understand where she's going with it? Like, do you think she looks into things way too much, or do you think she, by the end of the film, do you think she has helped and, you know, sorted out this problem that she has with herself?
I think the police throughout the film isn't effective.
Okay.
No, from her point of view, the police is definitely not effective. They're not making the strides in the investigation that she perceives that she is. So she's always trying to compensate where there isn't enough effort to solve that particular problem, and that can become a metaphor or a metaphor for any other problem that exists in society
she is
ready to take on. The inspector Ben Mahmoud only shows up on screen about four times.
Yeah, it's not a lot,
really.
Is it?
Yeah, exactly. Most of the time he's on the phone.
Yes.
And the last time you see him, he is berating her for taking it taking it too far, putting herself in danger as well, or harassing even Brian's family. So I think she thinks that she's doing the right thing. She thinks that it is her crusade, and if and nobody else will do it, then she will do it. She will take the whole thing on. And I think the Dardenne try to be fair to everyone, but I think they are being particularly critical of the police department of Liège and their way of investigating the murder of essentially an immigrant, from what we are led to believe.
Yes. Do you think in terms of, you mentioned fairness, do you think they are fair in their sort of criticism of sort of the social aspects of the film? Do you think they go far enough in criticising how people are looked after and treated and the insurance policies and the way crimes are solved and things like that? Or where do you think that lies?
I don't know. Because I was thinking a little bit about this film, like next to I, Daniel Blake, which we've recently seen, which is very, it's very strong on who it thinks the problem is that's making people kind of go through this terrible conditions of the welfare state and all that kind of thing. You know, it's very clear it blames Ian Duncan Smith, it blames the Conservatives in a big rant at the end. Whereas I don't think in this film it necessarily does blame anyone for this. I don't think it pins it on the police as a problem. The only person that's in a position of authority is the doctor, and she's trying to help. So it doesn't necessarily point out where the problem lies that's causing this.
Yeah, see, I'm glad you brought up Ken Loach, actually, because there's a lot of people that have said that the Dardenne are basically Belgium's version of Ken Loach. And I actually completely disagree, because Ken Loach has a very Manichean view of the world. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very black and white, and you have good versus evil, which is one way of looking at the world, definitely. But then I think the Dardenne try and instill a little bit more shades of grey inside their narrative and their characters. They try and not really point fingers ultimately at anyone at any level of society. They are just trying to tell stories, and by their own admission, they don't really have any political message. They let the audience take care of that, and their critics as well. But in my opinion, they are only there to maybe observe life or kind of film life as they see it as well in their urban environments, in their own country. And I think it would be unfair to shoehorn them in any particular political or social message. I think they are genuinely trying to tell you one story, and then whatever you bring to it, you come out with.
Yeah, I think that's a really nice way of putting it.
Yeah, and it lends itself to that, with the fact that there is no music in it at all. It's all just the natural sounds, the way it's filmed, the lighting used. It does just feel...
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Like, this could be a real thing that's happening at the moment, and that's in that city.
Yeah,
it's very realistic. Mm-hmm. Does anyone have any final points about this film?
I just wanted to quickly mention before we go into spoilers that I love that Dr. Jenny is a smoker. I was thinking about that a lot throughout the film. And, you know, I don't know if it's different in Belgium, but I would say that there aren't many doctors who are smokers who know all of those, you know, the health risks and all of that kind of thing.
I think you'd be surprised.
Maybe I would. But I love that she had this vice that, you know, even though she knew how bad it was for her and that she's painted as such a saint, she had this one thing that she went to for comfort that was kind of a bit destructive.
Lovely. So we are going to quickly just talk about a couple of spoilers. and then please do join us again, because we've got another film to talk about. We're going to talk about Chirac. So please turn off now. This is your spoiler warning. And we're back. So in terms of what we found out about the girl in the end, was that satisfactory to you?
I think through the first half of the film, obviously you're desperate to find out what happened to her, and you want it to kind of be a dramatic story, and you really want to know who she is, who killed her and why. And then I think as the film goes on, that became less important to me. I wanted to know her name in the same way that the doctor did. But also, it was important what was going on in the people who were living, who were caught up in this case, and why that had happened. In the end, I didn't really feel like I needed a resolve, because it's kind of obvious from the outset something tragic happened, and she had her head knocked in. And that wasn't going to change anything. It wasn't going to change because she was dead, whereas things could change within the community. I think I was more interested in that as it went on.
When the final scene came along where the girls, am I allowed to say?
Yeah, you can say.
When the girl's killer is found out to be one of Jenny's patients' father.
Yeah.
And it was all tied to his momentary lapse and into vice, basically. I had very conflicting feelings, because at first you have this man who really Jenny is extracting for a confession. She is begging him to say it so he can liberate both himself and her.
Yes, very
and
much
I was
so.
Like, just say it, just say it. You can do it. And then he vacates the room and then goes into her bathroom and then tries to hang himself. And I don't know if you guys noticed, but her first reaction was, "Is your neck okay?"
Yeah, she instantly becomes the doctor again.
Yeah,
in that
exactly.
Moment, yeah.
And I was looking at it, going, "You were fighting so hard. The camera was fighting so hard to prove to me your humanity, and you as a character, as Jenny. But you are actually Dr. Devin. You will always be a doctor.
Yes, yeah, doctor foremost.
Yeah, and." Then it goes on. The man actually finally gives in and calls the police. And I think it's a great scene where he says to her, "You can call the police now." And she gives him the phone and goes, "No, you do it. It's your responsibility." Yeah. Because somebody finally takes her responsibility away from her. She transfers that. And then the victim's sister comes in, tells her name. And I know the Dardenne are not really, like we just discussed this before, they want to tell a story of life. They they don't want to do political messages. But I was actually a little bit disappointed to know her name. Because that victim was, I was kind of happy for her to be the surrogate for every other person out there that could be suffering. It's nice to know that somebody cared. And I feel like the story kind of ended, and then Davin... Dr. Jenny, she hugs the sister, and that appears to be the end.
I thought the hug was so crucial in terms of that boundary between sort of her being a doctor and her being separate that she makes very clear at the beginning. I think it's the opposite. That big hug at the end, it sort of removes that boundary.
Like, you know, they can't touch and hug like that. They can be very compassionate and very caring, but that kind of physical barrier is not broken. And it's interesting that it felt like she kind of shed the doctor at that point and was like, "I'm just a person talking to another person about something that's affected both of us, and we both need this hug."
They both definitely need it.
Yeah.
And I really liked, with the kind of attempted suicide, almost how pathetic it was, you know, like, because the film's very kind of like day to day. It didn't do like a glamorous suicide, it didn't do like a big glamorous reveal of what happened. You know, he tried to do it in a grubby kind of place with a belt and it didn't work, and he kind of just felt pathetic afterwards. And I just liked that.
It wasn't a Hollywood thing where there was hanging and she saved him. Yeah, and there's loads of tension when the chair tipped or something like that. Yeah,
it was just kind of very realistic.
Also, I found that the conversation leading up to his attempt, Dr. Devin saying, "You need to tell this to people," and he's like, "No, because I have my job, I have my child, I have my wife who I'm trying to have a second chance with. And these are very real problems. Mm. This is not, it's not just, again, we're talking about Hollywood or big budget kind of movies where somebody's like, no, of course I won't because I just don't want to go to jail. And then you hear nothing else. Yes. No, this man has collateral. This man has a family. And he doesn't want to go because it will ruin everything. The way the actor kind of delivers his lines is—it's so naturalistic. It's so absolutely real that you can't feel. You can feel sorry for him, even though he has committed that crime. You do feel sorry for him
because it wasn't his intention, and you can see that. And you know, you also can kind of see that he's acting out in a society and in a kind of way his life is constructed. He doesn't mean to hurt her. He just isn't valuing her as a human. And it's kind of symptomatic of the whole society he's living in rather than... It kind of felt like to me it could have been any of them. It could have been the man who got the prostitute for his dad. It could have been the dad.
Yeah, there's so many suspects. Yeah.
And also, you know, it's kind of an Inspector Calls kind of thing, that it's not just one person's fault. It's, you know, somehow it turns out that it's everyone's fault.
Yeah.
Lovely. So that is The Unknown Girl, which is on Curzon Home Cinema from today, I believe.
Do give it a watch. It raises lots of questions.
Yeah, do check it out. Do give it a watch. We have just enough time to now talk about Chirac, the new Spike Lee film. Mm-hmm. I thoroughly enjoyed this film. Mm-hmm. I thought it had so much to it. I thought it was very on the nose, very much like Spike Lee is. Do you think it was too much on the nose at any point in this film?
Can I just interject?
Mm. Yeah.
I think in order to supremely understand Chirac, I just want to introduce the play that is based on, if that's okay.
That's great.
It's called Lysistrata. It's a 411 BC comedy written by Aristophanes. And there's a couple of things that you need to know going into Chirac that I think are vital components in order to understand Chirac a little bit more, is that the play premiered, in a way, opened.
Yeah.
Okay, yep.
During the festival of Dionysus, who is the Greek god of wine, ritual madness, and fertility, of all things.
Okay.
And the play opens with Lysistrata wondering where all the women are, because they're not on time, during her meeting in order to organize a sex strike in order to stop the Peloponnesian War. And then the play kind of devolves into this strange, there's extravagant set pieces, there are wonderfully poignant monologues, and then in the end, once the men finally relent, they're actually climbing up the Acropolis, which the women have taken over, bent over, and burdened, but completely, by their erections. And this is, and I am talking about men just wearing fake phalluses on their backs, trying to climb the Acropolis. This is Aristophanes at his best, I think. And he makes it sound ridiculous, but he taps into something that is just so ultimately so funny and so true. And I think Spike Lee manages, at least in a cinematic way, to really make it a wonderful little adaptation and reinterpretation of that play.
Yeah, and I think what's great is what Harry was saying about, you know, do you think it's too on the nose? I think, no, it's not, because it's set within this play that's, and you know, it's in verse or in rhyming couplets the whole way through. It's so over the top that it can be so overt in its message. You know, it says so many times. Yeah. I think the best example is John Cusack's preacher.
Oh, yeah. I love that character.
Amazing. Who knew John Cusack could be a preacher?
Yeah.
I think John Cusack's character is definitely also, he's a composite of Mike Corrigan or a real priest from Chicago and Spike Lee. He is the mouthpiece of Spike Lee.
Yeah, he's the message. He's the... You know, when he talks about Martin Luther King, and he talks about Malcolm X, and he talks about sort of reclaiming responsibility and what's happened and race relations and everything like that. He is Spike Lee at that moment. He's Spike, saying exactly what Spike Lee wants to say.
And I think another really great way that the message was put across was right at the beginning of the film with the song Chirac, with the stats and the lyrics on the screen. It's like 4 minutes long.
It's really,
so compelling. It's so compelling, and the message is so clear. It's a great song, and it really sets you up for where this whole film goes. I was going to say play then, because it almost does feel like a play.
I think it definitely is. I think Spike Lee definitely has a sense of the theatrical mm-hmm. in him ever from the beginning of his career. And he can do extravagant set pieces. He can do musical numbers. And he has this blunt forced rhetoric that is almost now impossible mm-hmm. to ignore. And I don't know about you guys, but what I really loved in this movie that I think is a stroke of genius on Lee's part is, you know that this is an adaptation of a play. You know, because they have the iambic pentameter, yep. the urban patois, mm-hmm. it's shot in a very theatrical way, and you're almost taken in by its kind of lightly fictional world. But then, bam, they give you names like Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, yeah. the Charleston yeah. Massacre. Yeah. They take you completely out of it again. It's such a violent clash of fictional versus brutal reality.
Yeah, it was so contemporary in its references of, like, Sandy Hook and Dylan... I can't remember
Dylan
his name.
Ruth.
Who went into the church and murdered those people. Yeah. It was so relevant, and it was so important, I think, to question where this was all coming from and yeah, I just absolutely loved this film. I thought it was amazing.
Yeah, so the film came out about a year ago in America.
Oh, did it?
I think it came out on Amazon. Mm-hmm. Do you still think it has that relevance now?
The time it came out in the States, it was during a week of very high profile shootings.
Yeah.
In the States, yeah. And then it comes out now with the election of Trump, mm. and Spike Lee gave an interview with The Guardian with Bernie Sanders only, look, the last weekend where it was printed off. And it's interesting because I think Liz Estrada in general is always really relevant.
Yeah.
I think it's still a critique on humanity and mankind waging war on each other.
Yeah, I mean, it's not changed, has it, from, what, 411 to now?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's a bit depressing, isn't it, that reality? What I really respect Spike Lee for doing was not... He didn't take on police brutality. He didn't take on kind of the war in Iraq or anything, even though the title might suggest that he could as well. But he took on black-on-black violence, which he calls self-inflicted genocide, mm-hmm. which I think is really interesting because he's a very militant man. And if you look at movies like Malcolm X, mm-hmm. he is very interested in the race relations in the States, especially between white and black. But here... He is this is an emergency announcement that he does is squarely pointed at the people that are, you know, victims of urban-centered violence and black-on-black violence. And he's trying to appeal to everyone saying, this does need to stop and we can all help. You all have the power
to
make it stop.
Yeah, it is. And yeah, definitely, his message is kind of like, you know, we're doing their job for them, or, you know, these bad people that don't want us to succeed, we're playing into it, we're putting ourselves in the state prisons and we're making the money, and, you know, we're going to end up in a hospital or we're going to end up in a morgue, and if we keep destroying each other, you know, they're just going to keep prospering. I just thought it was a very, very powerful film, very powerfully told, and so imaginative, so kind of like mesmerizing. I couldn't stop watching this film.
Yeah.
And I almost want to watch it again now.
There are so many. I'll just finally add this. And there, just to say, this is the first time I've ever seen Spike Lee do a Greek comedy from 411 BC, then add African American performance traditions, and then add references to West Side Story, The Wizard of Oz, Patton, and Dr. Strangelove. I mean, I was watching it going, what else are you going to throw at me? This is amazing. Yeah. You keep giving me stuff, and it's up to my interpretation, obviously, but it's just wonderful.
Yeah, but it's so easy to digest all that.
Yeah.
It's not like it comes at you and you sit there thinking about it and it's too much and it's too much information. I found it, while it was loads of information and loads of references, you were still able to have that and bring it in.
Yeah.
I just want to say as well, I love the strong female characters in this film. And they make the whole film. and the whole storyline, and I think that that's crucial, and it's great, and it's great to see that on film.
And
well.
Teyonna Parris, the woman that plays Lysistrata,
she's incredible,
wonderful,
amazing, amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think she's going to be going on to do amazing things. She's
definitely
an incredible actress.
Yeah,
definitely. So we were talking about Chirac, the new Spike Lee film, which is also on Curzon Home Cinema.
Wonderful.
Unfortunately, we have run out of time today, but the films we've talked about are Unknown Girl, which is on home cinema, and Chirac that we've just mentioned. If you enjoyed those films, us talking about those films, then please do check out Women on a Mission collection on Curzon Home Cinema. There's loads of great stuff on there, so check it out. If you've not seen any of the films on there, just watch it, enjoy. Next week we've sent our very own Jake Cunningham to talk about to Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Sadly, since the interview, Jake has been hidden away in a beach hut in Clacton-on-Sea and will not be released. And finally, if you are enjoying this podcast, do rate us on iTunes or any other podcast provider. Any feedback would be great for us. Hopefully you are enjoying it. But from us at the Curzon Film Podcast, it's goodbye from Ursi.
Bye-bye.
It's goodbye from Jenna.
Bye.
And it's goodbye from Harry. Goodbye.